Welcome to Are You Real? Finding the Authentic You, the podcast that focuses on Christians that are active in everyday life. Join in as we speak to everyone from successful business owners to educators to athletes about their faith and how it helps them reach out and revolutionize those around them to do the same. And now get ready to roar with your host, the voice of manifestation, John Fuller.
Hey, Roar Nation, John Fuller here, and I am fired up. Today is a special treat. This is fun. This is going to be part two. If you did not catch part one, I highly recommend going back to the interview with Nathan Von Minden and also Cameron Arnett, talking about Hollywood, different things, acting, producing. But most importantly, we talked about the Challenger disaster. For some of you, this will date you if you remember it. We're going to go back to the 80s. And for others, we've all seen the image of the Challenger going up in the air and sadly blowing up. So I'm excited today because for the first time, a movie has been produced about it. And I get the privilege of interviewing the man who did it. So that being said, Nathan, are you ready to roar, my friend?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely, man. This is going to be exciting. So, Nathan, for those who are going to log on for the first time and maybe have not caught past shows, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself before we dive into the movie?
Yeah, so I'm the writer and director of the new film, The Challenger Disaster, just recently released on iTunes and Amazon and theaters, starring Dean Cain, Glenn Morshower, the football coach, Les Miles. And I've got a background in aerospace engineering, and we thought that this was a film that people would really respond to. And so we decided to make it. And, it's a completely independently funded and completely independently produced film that, we're excited to share with everyone.
Absolutely. So I'm just curious from my side, I don't know about other people, but how does that industry work as far as going out? Like, you got to, obviously you're not, super wealthy and you got a ton of money sitting in your pocket and you got to go out and raise funds and all that. Like, how does that work?
Well, it's like starting a very risky business, basically, like a restaurant or something.
Yeah.
And it all hinges on the product and how well it's made. And so we have to try and get investors on the team, and we have to make something that the investors will think is worth their time and energy and convince them to invest in the film. And so, that's one of the frustrating things as a creative. I spent so many years trying to learn how to produce films and, be theologically accurate and whatever it is I do. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, and you've got to be a businessman and understand all that. And so it's been many years of trying to get up to speed and a lot of false starts. But finally, a few years ago, we got it right with the Challenger disaster, and we're able to find the people to help us out with it. And, trying to get into filmmaking, there's no one way to do it. There's no, here's where you turn in your resume and say, I want to make movies. It's like starting your own business. You have to, make the numbers work. You have to find an audience for your product. I've always kind of told people we're just another widget maker trying to make a widget factory. It just happens to be these films that we care about. Most of them are true stories. And yeah, so that's a little bit about how it came about and where I'm coming from on it. You're a business owner.
Oh, I totally get it. We got multiple businesses, man. It's just, you got a passion for it and you just kind of jump in and do it. I'm curious though, how did you get into movie producing? Because I like what you said though, there's no one way, because for a lot of people, they would think, well, I got to go to school and then I got to find the right person. And then you got to do all these things. And obviously I like the fact that you said there is no one way. How did you get into that?
So, for the last 15 years, I've been producing, mostly working at churches, large churches. I've worked in six really big churches that could afford like a production guy like myself. And so I kind of got started by serving in the church. I would make videos, testimonies, things like that of people's lives and stories, promos, animation, sermon bumpers, just whatever it takes. I was doing that. And then in 2011, I was asked by Living Water International and Attack Poverty, who were both in the Houston area, to make a documentary called Uganda Man. And so we went over to Uganda, hustled a movie up out of that. And I kind of approached it differently. I thought, we're talking about the water crisis. How do I come at this from an angle that helps people connect? Because I'm having an engineering background. I have a degree in aerospace. I'm really jazzed up by numbers and facts and statistics. But the other side of me, it was like, I need to come at this from a personal perspective. I need people to see a human being in this story that they can relate to, that has the same, money problems, girl problems, work problems over there. And that's kind of how we did it. And we found a lot of success with Uganda Man. The film earned many, many times more than it cost to make. And that kind of set us off to the races. And so that's kind of how I got into filmmaking, was, having a passion for it and doing it and loving it and, all that.
We won't focus too much on that, but I'm just curious. I did see that in your paper where you said, I think the film, you said you did that on a budget of $5,000 and you raised over $200,000. Is that right? For Uganda Man?
Yeah. And that's the business side of it. And that's where I started to learn, it's the entertainment business. Like, you have to be not only, it's a two-edged sword, really, because not only you have to be decent at making this art, you have to also have to be a businessman. And then and throw another wrench in it, as believers, we have to be, it has to be a ministry. So you have to satisfy those three different angles when it comes to, well, for me, whenever it comes to all the stuff that I produced. And, Challenger isn't a Bible movie. Like, it doesn't have Bible quotes in it. They're not talking about Jesus. But it carries the biblical worldview of the importance of human life. And I think that's why me and a lot of my investors got on board with it, was because we feel like I know it's a relevant topic today, with all that's going on. And so that's kind of what led us down this path. Being financially smart, I think that's one of the things that a lot of people getting into the film arena really miss out on. And it does two things. One, it allows people to not get their films made because they don't have a business plan in place. That happened to me for many, many years. I was just approaching people with vision only.
Yeah.
Whenever my time in church work, 15 years serving the church, how many giving campaigns have I been a part of? And I started adding it up. I'd been a part of 9 giving campaigns and helped raise over $20 million for churches I've worked for through the videos and different levels. Like, sometimes I was just the guy that went out and did a thing, and all the way up to I was helping craft the message. And so I thought, okay, how do I take that, what I've learned about raising funds, into this world? And that's where I settled on, you have to pitch vision and then you have to pitch financial to people. And that's kind of where I had the spark of idea of how to, or really the approach to take. It's nothing groundbreaking. It's just, for me, it was sticking to those two things, getting people excited about telling this story that we thought our nation would be interested in. And then, the second question is, how do I get my money back?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you say that. A lot of times I don't think we realize that we have more experience than we actually do. In the sense that you said, I looked back and I looked at things that I had already done. So a lot of times we would look, I'm speaking for you, but if I was in your shoes, I would think, oh, well, I've raised money. Like, you don't think anything of it, but then all of a sudden it's kind of one of those Holy Spirit deals where you realize, like, wait a second, I've raised money. If I can raise money in church to help with the campaign, it's the same concept. Sometimes you just got to be able to put them together. And you kind of have that aha moment, like, hey, I can do this.
Yeah. Yeah. And, having done so many of those campaigns, I just thought, well, why can't I, I've seen how it's done. Why can't I, you know, and, you know, when you serve on a church staff, you're like, okay, every 2 years, it's like, all right, we got to do another giving campaign, and you roll your eyes and you trudge off to work to do it. But, and it's kind of like those reading those parts in like Exodus and Leviticus that are really boring. You're like, ugh, I can't believe I have to do this again. But, and then it becomes like, once you realize how important it is, you're like, whoa, I didn't realize that at the time, you know? And that's kind of how I felt about those giving campaigns, was like, man, I mean, you trudge through it, but at the end of the day, you're like, man, I gained so much experience from that stuff and how to do things, how not to do things. And, you know, luckily too, I'd been, always insisted on being in charge of my own budget so that I could learn that, because it's not a area that I wanted to be good at. So I wasn't extremely interested in it, but, and so I kind of had to force myself, you know, because I think a lot of creatives will want to be just creative, or at least I was. And I was missing that piece of the puzzle. And so what happens in the film business is the market starts having these people make films that cost too much, that don't make their money back. And so that makes the look rest of us look bad. And that's why everybody thinks filmmaking is a risky endeavor, but it only is as if you get tied up with someone who maybe isn't, you know, putting the work in financially, I think, on these things. And so we just decided, well, we're going to lower the risk, find out all the risk points and lower it. And, you know, luckily investors responded to it.
I'm really interested in the business side, and we're going to intertwine that in with the movie as well as how you did that. But when you talk about, so when you brought the Challenger disaster to your investors, how did you lower your risk? Like, what are the typical risks that they saw, and how did you figure out a way to lower those?
Well, risk points are like high budget, things that lower risk are it being based on existing IPs, intellectual properties. And that just means, in the most layman's term, stuff that people already know about. That's why you see so many books and remakes. I mean, for me, I'm highly attracted to true stories, you know. Yeah. About everything we're working on right now is a true story. You know, and that comes from years of just praying for God to help us connect with the right story, or stories that at least speak to me. Like a Challenger disaster was something I learned back in college when I was learning to be an engineer, and it's a case study. And so it's one of those stories that haunted me. And that's kind of what I'm looking for in a story, is what keeps me up at night, what, you know, makes me become an obsessive researcher. And the Challenger, when I learned about the engineers that tried to stop the launch, that's when I became obsessive. And I spent about 8 years researching it. And, you know, that's kind of what I'm looking for. It's on a gut level where you just go, oh man, that fascinates me so much, I have to look into it. And that's kind of the approach we took.
I'm glad you said that. I was going to bring that up. I had read that you had researched this for 8 years. Why don't you talk about some of that as far as the research and compiling your notes? Cause that is a really long time. I mean, people don't realize this isn't a movie that just happened and you're like, hey, there's a movie out. I mean, this is 8 to 10 years in the making, right?
Yeah. You know, I finally got serious about researching it about 8 years ago, and because I learned about it in college, and you just keep in the back of my, and I thought, surely somebody has made a movie about this already. But when I found out, you know, that wasn't the case, that's when I kind of dropped myself into it, and I said, okay, let me just jump into the water here and see how it's going to be. Well, it's really like jumping into the ocean when there's so much material on a subject like this. And then you just go, which direction do I swim? And so I just sort of picked a direction and started swimming. And for me, the place where I think we learned the most about this was the Rogers Commission. You know, in 1986, President Reagan commissioned this investigative panel to look into what happened. Why did this thing blow up? And that's where I started to learn more about the characters, the people behind the story. And then it fascinated me even more in their personalities. You know, our main character is based on a guy named Roger Beaujolais. And he was just kind of a hothead, a guy that people struggled to work with. He struggled to communicate. And you take a person like that and drop them into a scenario like this, it's volatile. And, you know, one of my favorite movies of all time are talk heavy movies like 12 Angry Men. Like, I just love that movie. Moneyball, The Insider, Paths of Glory. You know, I love those kinds of films. And so I'd always watch them and you see that spark, you know, the paths line up one day where you go, oh, it's a movie like this. You know, it's not really a space movie, you know, it's more of a legal drama. And I just love that kind of stuff. You know, like, A Few Good Men. Is that the one with Jack Nicholson in it? You Can't Handle the Truth.
Yeah. That's right.
Like I love those kinds of movies. And, yeah. And so we set out to make something like that. And, you know, and then I put pen to, and then for me, like whenever I am researching a story and writing it, into a script, I like to build up enough stuff in the bank to where it just falls out of my head on the paper. And it's just trying to keep up at that point. And I finally got to that point where it's like, I cannot not write this anymore. Yeah. And that's usually what I'm looking for as a writer in the research phase is there's so much stuff that it just finds its own way onto the page. And then it's just, you know, massive amounts of rewrites and showing it to people who, you know, give feedback and you just gain partners along the way like that. And so that's kind of how I went about that.
Just curious, who played, I'm looking at your starring cast, who played Roger?
Eric Hansen played a guy named, we changed all the names in the film because once you get beyond a couple of the main characters, we had to take some creative license with some people. And we just felt it was fair to everyone on the wrong side of history, the right side of history to change their names. But every time, you know, these characters talk or speak about things that happened, that really, I think would affect that do affect the truth, the outcome of the, like, where does blame fall? A lot of that stuff was lifted out of their own arguments, their own testimony during the Rogers Commission. And so we tried to really stick to the facts on this. And, you know, one of the things too, I appreciate, did you ever see the movie Moneyball about the baseball, the A's?
Yeah. It's been quite a while. Was Brad Pitt in that one?
Yeah. And so I love that film, but here's the thing. I don't know anything about baseball. I don't watch baseball. I don't go to baseball games, but I found myself loving it because there was so much more going on than just baseball talk. And so that's kind of how we approach the Challenger disaster is, everything behind the engineering talk has to have an emotional quality to it. And so every line is about jockeying for position, power struggle, you know, dismissal, how, you know, I love movies where highly intelligent people take the gloves off with each other. And, you know, we found that to be true in the real story. And so we just brought that over into the film and, you know, tried to chase that in the movie. And, so that's one of the things I personally enjoyed about the film and what kept me going.
What was fun about Roger's part, and the reason I asked that is Eric did a really good job, is it's like in one part of it, you're rooting for him in the sense of like you, because you obviously your hindsight, you know what's going to happen. So you're rooting for him. But at the same time, I find myself just thinking, man, you're an idiot. Like at the same time, I'm thinking you're so brilliant, but yet you're so stupid because it just felt like all he cared about was being right. Like over and over in the movie, he's like, but I'm right. And I kept on thinking about that. I'm like, that's great that you're right. But if you can't communicate, I was telling my wife that this morning, if you can't communicate properly to people, it doesn't matter how right you are. If you can't convey your message, like for example, it doesn't matter how good your movies are. If you can't raise money to get the movie produced, it doesn't matter how good it is. It's never going to happen. And it's the same thing. Yeah. And it's the same thing with being right. You can have all the facts, but if you're a hothead and you can't communicate them right, you're never gonna have people follow you or buy into what you have to say. And that was the struggle that you see going on so much in that movie, is that struggle that he's having.
Yeah, I think that's what's interesting too, as we sort of release this thing into the wild, is how people find themselves in the film. You know, are you the Adam Roger character that cannot, his mouth gets him in trouble more than anything? Are we the people that want to just be done with it and not fight the battle, you know, just get home and get some dinner? You know, are we the people that really want to protect our jobs at all costs and are willing to try to shut down somebody? You know, are we the cover up people, or are we the whistleblowers? Like, and you know, writing the film, I kind of had to find myself in all of that, you know, even the people on the wrong side of the decision. And it's really interesting to hear people's responses to where they see themselves. I mean, that character's problem is something I've identified with my whole life, is, you know, it's not what you said, it's how you said it. And so trying to figure out really what that person's about was pretty easy for me, but how that person needs to deal with it and also be dealt with by others, was kind of fascinating too, to kind of go, what is effective with a person like this from other people, and how do different personality? I mean, it was just a really interesting mixing pot for me to throw all these personality types in a room like that and let them have at each other.
Yeah. I'm just curious, who did you feel like you identified with the most in the movie, character wise?
Oh, the main character for sure.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's how, again, it's based on Roger Beaujolais. I think that's how he was in real life. You know, I'm right, you should have just listened to me. And it's true. It's obviously very, very true. It's tragically true. But I think that's the dichotomy of a guy like that, is, you know, if he wasn't that way, would he have even gotten the conversation going?
Right.
But if he wasn't that way, would people have maybe listened a little better? You know, I don't know. I don't know why people like that exist. I think there's something there, even in that, when it's, you know, taken to its extreme, yes, it's a bad thing, but there's gotta be a middle ground somewhere for people like us that, you know, we exist and are positive help to society, you know, to be unwavering. And, but it's like the prophet in his own town, you know, it's just not, it's a hard thing for people to hear, but if you're cutting about it, and if you're dismissive to others and you try to cut them off at the knees, then they're probably just going to want to take you up on your fight, you know? And so that's not a way to do things either. And yeah, so I worked out a lot of demons on this.
It was good. Okay. So let's go to, who did, Cameron, we've had Cameron on the show before. I really enjoy Cameron. Who did Cameron play?
Cameron plays a guy named Bill. He's kind of like the more level-headed person who wants to hear on all sides. And, you know, for a character like that, it was fun to sort of drop a level-headed person into a really nuts scenario and really push them to their extreme and see what they're like at their edges, you know? And same thing with all these characters. It's, you know, you drop someone in there that's mild-mannered, or, you know, Cameron plays the guy, Bill, who's like a mentor. And I've always wondered, because I've got a few mentors in my life, like, what would it be like if they were really pushed to the max? What would happen to them? You know? And so talking to some of those guys, going, where in your life were you and how did you respond to it? You know? And, coupled again with, you know, the real life testimony of guys like, Arnold Thompson and Bob Ebling and some of the other engineers that were part of the, what they called the Five Lepers. There were these guys that were sort of outcast in the space program, the company that they worked at in Utah after they, you know, blew the whistle on the whole thing. So it was kind of interesting to see those guys and take their personalities and drop them in with each other and see how the whole thing comes together.
It was, and the reason I asked it, I probably related the most. So at the beginning, the younger me, I related a lot to the main character. But I have a very level-headed wife who for years has told me, like, you know, pay attention to what you say. You can't say it like that. you can't talk to people that way. And especially owning a business and do so, I've really learned to think before I speak. Because honestly, if I said, and I tell people this, and I'm honest about it, if I said half of the things that I think, sometimes people would hate me. Because honestly, I mean, sometimes people do stuff, and I relate to that character. I just want to look at them and be like, "Are you really that stupid?" And but then I have to filter that and say, "Well, would Jesus say that to somebody? Absolutely not. Like he would love them, but he would say it much." He would be honest, but kinder.
Yeah.
And that's how I rate. But actually who I related the most was Bill, in the sense that even gone through like a leadership classes and different stuff, where there was a part in the movie where they're all standing in the hall and they're kind of having, I think it's right after they realize they have 45 minutes to make this happen. And Bill's like there and he looks over, at Roger and basically tells him, he's like, "I know Roger doesn't give a crap about you. He doesn't give a crap about me. He doesn't care about your feelings. He does want to be right." Like he just has this moment where Bill just says, "Listen, he doesn't give a crap, but he's right. And we're going to figure out how to make this work. And we're going to come together." So he kind of rallies everybody to say, "Let's do this." Yeah. Like, this isn't about your feelings. This isn't about my feelings. This isn't who gives a crap about Roger, and Roger doesn't give a crap about us, but we're going to do the right thing. And let's just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that cuts the main character pretty deep. And you know, we tried to write that scene in a way that again, brings out that type of person, that mentor person, again, under that extreme pressure, how would a person react? And from what I found is, you know, they react with the same level of truth, just spoken a little more kindly. And again, you know, watching him unravel in those moments, I'm always interested by that. Is like watching a character sort of get pushed to the extreme. it's kind of twisted in a way, you know.
Yeah, you can tell in the movie it does break him, because I think he realizes, like, I'm not conveying my message right. Like, yes, I'm right. But yeah, I think I don't know if it's that moment he realizes, well, everybody around me, people don't think that I care about them. And maybe he does, he just doesn't know how to show it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, when you live so long in that arena, if you're an angry person or if you're a combative person, you know, everything's a fight. It's hard to get perspective from yourself because, you know, if you live with such a low flashpoint your whole life, it's hard to manage that as you get older. It's like trying to bring your GPA up once it's down, you know, it takes some real work and effort. And I know for me, it's very tempting to go, "I was nice twice today. Like, why do I have to continue?" Doesn't that bring the average up? And it's like, no, it's not nearly enough. You know, it has to be a continual ongoing, you know, it has to become a new habit, a new part of you. And so it's hard to get to that point. So anybody that's walked through that from that angle, you know, it's difficult. And I think it's this, you know, like my wife is kind of the same way. Like she's a little bit opposite of me. And so seeing her sort of grow in her, you know, I'm going to speak up and say something, you know, I don't like this. That can be difficult for those kinds of people too. And it's, you know, I think God puts us with folks like that in our life. And again, I try to actively seek out people who are much different than me, than, you know, the things that I need to grow in and sort of trick them into mentoring me, you know, coffee and lunches and, you know, stuff like that.
You know, it's funny, when I was younger, I would look at people like that and they would irritate me and I'd be like, "Why aren't you more like me?" Or, mm-hmm. And obviously it was a major lack of maturity, but as you get older, you start to realize, hey, I need that person in my life because they are, what I don't like about them is actually what I need.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you start to grab that. Okay. So let's kind of dive into some of the other people. You had some really good other actors. Obviously they're in there. I'm looking at one right now, Dean Cain. Which I don't remember. I'd have to go back. I don't think I paid attention to the 90s series. Was he was Superman?
Yeah, that's right. Dean Cain, Superman, was on set. That was a fun time with Dean. Man, he's an imposing force of a person. And, you know, we were able to have, so we sort of shot the movie in a way to where we shot the bulk of it. And then we took a break, and we were going to try and, you know, put together a trailer or something like that, and then entice some, more well-known people to come on our team, like Glenn Morshower, who, you know, nobody recognizes his name, but they recognize his face. You know, he played Aaron Pierce on 24, and he's in all the Transformer movies. But a guy like Dean, like, we showed him the trailer, and he really loves historical stuff. And, you know, he really dug what we were doing and said he'd come on and help us. And he was such a great asset to the team. It's interesting to see different people's acting styles, you know, as a director, to see how they kind of come on set and how they, you know, everybody's different and how they, their flavor and style. And so as a leader, I have to sort of, I've always seen the best leaders, they change their leadership style per person. And so, that's what I tried to do on this film. And so when certain actors would come in and need one thing, and that's sort of what I took on too, was going, what helps you best as an actor? Like, knowing, you know, does this person like to go first? Like, or do they need a few to warm up? Just little things like that. And so Dean was one of those guys that, I mean, it was a little bit intimidating to have him on set, but as soon as he walked in, he was so gracious. He's like, all right, man, whatever you want to do, you just let me know. And here we go. And so he took, he's a real team player. Like, he was on the team, and it wasn't like having an other join us. Like, he came in and he was just super generous with the other actors. And, you know, even whenever we did coverage, like, he insisted on staying in, you know, when we're shooting over his shoulder and it could be anybody, he was in there, and he just took it on like a champ, you know. He's an old pro at it.
I'm curious, you said you were intimidated at first. Why?
Well, first off, it's Dean Cain. And then secondly, like, he's literally a big imposing guy. Like, he used to play football and he used to be Superman, and in real life, I mean, his arms are like tree trunks, you know? And so that kind of dude, when he walks in, you just call him sir. And, and beyond that, you know, he's also a very lively person, you know, he's got a lot of energy. And so, sometimes a highly energetic person, you know, will, sort of run off in whatever direction they want to whenever there's not a solid game plan. And, you know, I gave every actor the same pep talk before they came on set. Was like, hey, we don't have a lot of time here. We don't have a lot of money here. I expect you to show up with your lines memorized. We're not going to spend a lot of time figuring out on set. And we would have these Skype rehearsals with me and the other person, kind of like we're doing right now. Yeah. And we would walk through all the lines, and you know, I write, not because I love it, but out of necessity. I'm beginning to love it a little bit more, but I'm not precious with my words. And so if an actor felt like, you know, this isn't feeling right, or I'd say it a little differently, we would change it, you know, because I've always thought cheesiness in a film is when somebody does something without a good enough motivation. They're just doing it because the writer wants them to do it, or it doesn't, it feels shoehorned in, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where things start to feel cheesy. And so Dean came on prepared. He showed up on the first day. And so I think our preparedness and his preparedness really jived. Like, he appreciated that, and we appreciated that about him. And so everything just got along smoothly. You know, it's when people show up on set and things aren't ready to go and you're waiting around for a few hours, that's where people get frustrated, you know? And so we had a great team of producers on this thing, getting our schedule set out. And so I attribute that relationship working and, you know, the creative environment working because of the people that we brought onto the team to help set that environment. So like Erica Waldorf's a producer. We've worked together in church work before. Glenn Gordon, my other producer, he's a pastor. And I knew, I wanted people I could not only trust with my life and like hand them a bank card that you know, has many, many dollars on it and trust them to do the right thing. But also when there's a problem on set or, you know, somebody who knows how to make things run smoothly, we wanted people to come on our film set and have a good time and want to work with us again, because, you know, I'm interested in making more than one movie.
Yeah.
And so I believe that that helped us out with a lot of people to go, oh, this is a set you want to be on, because there's, it's, you know, we over communicated with people. We, you know, it's in leadership, you solve 90% of your problems by starting on time, ending on time, and feeding people, you know? And so we stuck to that. And then any kind of problems that came up, they dealt with those. And, you know, I felt like it made for a really, it helped the creative process, because all that preparedness allows you then to, when you get on set, you're not just trying to figure it out to make it acceptable. Now you're trying to take it to the next level and make it a little bit better, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So I can put the face with the name. I'm just trying to, Dean's character, is he the lawyer that's, kind of telling them what to say? He makes Roger mad at one point sitting on the couch. He's like, are you telling me to lie?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Okay. Yeah. He does a great job. He almost comes off as like, he does a great job as a lawyer, because he comes off as like this pushy kind of car salesman, charismatic preacher. Like, I don't know how to like to put him in, but he does a great job. Like, he's excited, kind of telling them what to do, and then just really pisses them off at the same time. He does a great job.
Yeah. You know, and that's where, you know, I think another thing that attracted Dean is like, he gets to play a kind of a bad guy a little bit.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is how he and Glenn's character sort of reverse positions and all that, you know, he was on board with and really enjoyed, you know, chewing someone's head off.
Yeah.
Basically in the film. And yeah, he was a lot of fun to watch. And in fact, there's a scene in there where, you know, Dean gets this like very intense, like he just crawls up in their face and just lets them have it for like 90 seconds. And we were shooting the thing. And so the DP's like, well, do you want to get coverage on that? And I was like, no, like that's the shot. Like, you wouldn't dare cut away from Dean Cain in that moment. You know, even in editing, like that was the one time where it's like, we don't need coverage on this. Like, this is it. There's no other way it could be, because, you know, being locked in that moment with him was so, you know, it's electric, you know?
Yeah, that's good. Okay. I'm really interested in this one. I had to look him up. I didn't realize, Les Miles. So that was really interesting to me. So he's a head coach at LSU. He's won titles. I mean, the guy's obviously renowned. So the guy's a stud there. How the heck does he get involved with you, and what is he doing in filmmaking? Cause it's just a really, it just comes off really weird. Like, I'm reading all this paperwork and I'm like, wait a second, he's a coach. What is he doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Coach Miles. He's an interesting cat. You know, he won a championship with LSU. He just got hired on as the new head coach at Kansas. And I think he's going to turn that program around, and just, he's a winner. Like, the guy, he's just a really impressive person. He just wants to be an actor. Like, he loves films. And I think, that's what it takes. You know, it takes, you have to love this stuff, because it's not, like, nobody's getting rich off of this, you know, stuff. And I'm not getting rich off of it, that's for sure. But, you know, he really loved it and wanted to do it. And so he contacted us and wanted to, and I said, sure, as long as he can act, you know, because we didn't have a ton of money. We just said, we can't hire the most expensive actors, but we can darn sure find the best actors. And so he was coming into a cast that was mostly filled up at that point. And, there were a few parts left, and we said, you know, what's he got? And so we put him through the ringer. Like, we made him audition like everybody else. We did two auditions with him, and, we really liked what he had. And so then it was like, how does Les fit in? You know, he's a football coach. This isn't about football. So like, what, cause as a, you know, as I'm casting a movie, I'm thinking, what is a part of a person that kind of has that spark of the character in them? And then I thought, you know, Les is a man who's led organizations almost as big as, you know, the space program. These college football programs are massive, you know, so many people to lead and huge budgets and a lot of pressure. And he's a man of incredible intellect. You know, it takes more than just football knowledge to run a program like that. It takes relational EQ kind of stuff to run it. And so we put him into this decision maker role, and, you know, he brought his A game. He showed up, gave him the same talk too, and he showed up prepared, and he was ready to go. And, you know, it was really neat for me too, was having him on set. I got to pick his brain about, you know, leading an organization and, you know, see what he thought about this and these kinds of issues. And, hey, how do you handle situations like this? And so we would kind of talk about that in our in-between times if we ever got a minute. He probably got tired of me trying to get free advice from him.
I'm curious. Why don't you nail on that real quick? What do you feel like one of your biggest takeaways was from Les? Like, maybe he helped you through something.
You know, one of the things he reminded me of was how you can be successful and you can lead these organizations and also have a good family life. Like, he was like, I go to the games with my kids. I'm not one of those guys that's like, you know, at all costs, I'm going to win championships and be the best leader. He's like, I would leave a practice to go watch my kids' volleyball practice or something like that. Like, he figured out a way, and he just cut other things out of his life to make his family a priority. And you can see that, you know, I've been over to his house a few times, and you can see like they've got a solid family structure and foundation, and that's how they're able to do big things together as a family. And yeah, one of the funny stories about Les was one day we're doing a scene, and we're trying to get him to 11, you know, like really get him up there. And a buddy of mine goes, "Hey, why don't you go tell Les, like, hey, talk to him like it's, you know, halftime or something." And I was like, man, if I try to talk to Les Miles about football, he's going to drop kick my head across it. That's not going to work. So I went up to him and I said, "Hey man, can you talk to them like you're going to fire him?" And he goes, "You know, once I get to the point with somebody where I'm firing them, like, you know, it's a lot more calm." And, you know, I go, "Okay, give him the come to Jesus talk, the talk before you fire him, like 3 months before." And he goes, "Okay, I know what you're talking about." He's like, "I've done that many, many times." And he was able to light into him. And just, I always find, I love that kind of stuff in films when characters kind of talk tough to each other.
Yeah, that's good. Okay, so let's hit on one more who I need to look up. Glenn, is it Morshower?
Yeah, Glenn Morshower.
Okay.
He's a guy, again, he's been in 24. He was a series regular on that. I think he's in the show The Resident on Fox right now. He's a series regular on that and all the Transformer movies. He's a guy I've seen in stuff, and my wife and I cried when Aaron Pierce died on 24. So Glenn Morshower has always been on.
I'm trying to remember that. My wife got me stuck. We would literally have 24 marathons when I'm telling you, we would watch like 12 episodes in a row. Yeah. I remember finishing an entire season in a weekend. And now I'm like having to go back. I'm like, I know I've seen this guy a gazillion times now. I got to go back and remember who he was.
He's a redheaded Secret Service agent.
Okay.
That is in the show and kind of helps the presidents out from here and there. And, you know, and he's an interesting guy too, because he's from Dallas. And a lot of the actors in the film, you know, we had a total Texas cast in the movie. Except for Dean. Glenn leads, he teaches these acting classes. He loves teaching actors. Like, that's a passion of his that, he loves it almost as much as he loves being in projects. And so a lot of the guys showed him the trailer. He jumped in and wanted to be a part of it. And, you know, he was much different than Dean. You know, Dean is like a ball of energy. Glenn, and so is Eric. Eric Hansen is like our lead actor. He's a guy that brings the team together. Glenn Morshower is like, he shows up on set and he wants to walk into the reality of it and is very in it with his co-actors and really gives not much else thought. And so he brought a level of focus on those days that I really appreciated. And he was able to stay in it, you know, like it can get a little bit thick being in these scenes. Like there's an energy in the room that feels heavy or low, but he was able to kind of stick with it for long periods of time, which was really, it's just interesting to see all these different actors do their craft, you know?
Yeah. What for you was the biggest message that you wanted to convey in the movie from the sense? At the beginning of the show, we talked about, like, you know, we're not talking about Jesus here. There's no religious quotations or anything like that. But the core of who you are is obviously you love the Lord and using your gifts and talents to bring to the world in an indirect way, if that makes sense. But through that, I know that you brought a message forth for people. What message, like if we haven't seen the movie yet, what message did you feel like you were trying to convey to people watching?
So I think, like, you know, the view from space, you know, 7 miles up, what's the takeaway? And it's for me, the whole Challenger thing and the engineers trying to stop it and then making the decision anyways, the real story for me hits home in the life is important. I don't know why the value of human life has been so devalued in our culture. It disgusts me to no end. I don't know why people kill each other for no reasons. I don't know why abortion is legal. I don't know why we've so devalued human beings in the most civilized culture since the beginning of time. Like it makes no sense. It feels like we're one step away from being, you know, the Aztecs cutting off people's heads and pyramids. You know, I just don't understand it. It bothers me. And so I think it bothers a lot of people, especially when they learn about the engineers trying to stop it and those 7 people up on that rocket and what happened to the value of their lives, what happens to the value of anybody's life, you know, in our culture. So I just find that topic to be so relevant today that, we couldn't not say something about it. And, you know, this movie is one of the ways that we're doing it.
That's good. I'm just curious, has anybody reached out to you that had anything to do with the actual events as far as people who passed away or were involved in any of it? Were you able to get contact with anybody?
No, most of them have passed away. There's a few people alive, but I think that's not something they are ready to talk about even now. Many of the engineers who tried to stop the launch, you know, they went to their deathbeds with this shame and guilt over them. And I just couldn't live with that either. You know, they're heroes. They're American heroes. They're whistleblowers. Our forefathers created laws to protect whistleblowers, people who would stand up for the, you know, common good, for the good of, health concerns, safety concerns. Those laws have been on the books since our nation's founding. And so I felt like they deserved that, even posterity, their legacy to live on, through our little film, which does not do them justice for the actual job that they did. And so, I'm so grateful to those guys to being an inspiration to me and to other people. And I honestly, like, we need more people like that. We need more people willing to stand up for what's right. And they're going to do it wrong, just like the guy in our film did it wrong. Some people are going to do it right. Some people are not going to do it at all. You know, some of us are going to get the option to do nothing or do something right. I think that's where most of us land in the decision categories. Can you just go home for the night? Can you just wipe your hands clean of it? Or do you stand up and say something? I think that's a decision a lot of us are going to have, more than do you do the right thing or do the wrong thing, is do you follow your apathy? Since most of them have passed away, we try to let their words live on by their testimonies that they gave and, you know, what they had to say about their experience. And, so it's a little bit tragic that, you know, they died with that hanging over them, despite the fact that they did the right thing. You know, why were they the ones that were tortured and punished endlessly throughout their life when they were the ones trying to do the right thing? I don't know the answer to that one.
That makes, that was one thing I was really curious, just at the end as we kind of wrap up the show, what happened to those guys? Because obviously, the show ends, you don't really know what happens to them. And I'm just assuming like you just get kicked out. I don't know. Do you get kicked out? Do you get stuck in a cubby hole now the rest of your life because you spoke up against the company? I mean, that had to be a really crappy place to be in for them.
Yeah. You know, they were called the five lepers at, in the real life story, they worked at Morton Thiokol and they were called the five lepers, and some of them were demoted. And that's not allowed to happen. That's what those whistleblower laws protect, especially for things connected to federal programs. And I wish more states had local laws to protect whistleblowers. But some of them remained in the program, space program, and tried to help it get better. Some of them could not handle it and decided to leave. The real life Bob Ebling, he left and went and started a duck sanctuary. Roger Beaujolais eventually quit and began going around to universities, giving lectures on ethics and management and decision making. Alan McDonald stayed in and, you know, tried to help the space program get better. In fact, he was demoted in Congress. It's the first time in American history where somebody's job was reinstated. They said, you cannot demote this person for being a whistleblower. They did the right thing. You have to reinstate to them to a job of similar power immediately, not tomorrow, today, as soon as this phone call is done. And so, you know, luckily that was recognized and he was, so that's unfortunate that that kind of thing would happen, but, that's what happened to most of them. And, you know,
That's powerful. I mean, I think sometimes I think there's a lot of self-reflection there. We have to realize, is it worth the cost? Like, are we willing, if we know what they went through and we're going to get ostracized or those things, are we willing to stand up for what's right in the face of seven people died? And obviously not all of us have to face something of that amount of pressure, but every day we have choices, that people are affected. And are we going to stand up for what's right, knowing that we could be frowned upon or stuck in the corner type deal?
Absolutely.
So that's really good. Okay. Where do we find the movie? I got the special privilege, man. I am so bummed out. I was actually in Dallas. I so wanted to make it with you guys. Like, we had every intention, but we have three teenagers. We had basketball games. We were there. Like, it was a rush. We actually had to drive home the night that you premiered it. And I was really bummed out because I wanted to meet you guys and see you in person. But anyways, we did watch it though, and I'm very thankful for it. So where do we find it? So how do my listeners get a hold of the movie, watch it, the whole deal?
You know, the two best places to find it are iTunes and Amazon. You can go on there today and find us. And then it's, you know, Vudu, Redbox, Instant. I think it's on some cable providers too, like Spectrum and all those. You know, it's out there. So just look for, or you can go to the challengerdisaster.com and you can click on a link there. But really, just go to iTunes and Amazon. Be sure to rate and review us. And we're very small fish in a very big pond. So everyone's support and help is much appreciated. So, you know, go buy our movie.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I'm going to give you the last word. If you got anything else to say, or if you want to share with our audience as I wrap it up.
You know, we're working on some new films. We're in the midst of trying to raise funds for a movie called The Smugglers. It's about a group of guys that try to smuggle a million Bibles into communist China in 1981. And so hopefully we can get that thing made, and love to see you guys at the movies.
Absolutely. All right. Well, hold on just a second. Roar Nation, man, I just look at you guys as a family, and I honestly do. And I'm just asking you guys, we don't benefit anything from this at Are You Real at all. And I'm just asking right now, if you guys would take the time, please support him, what they're doing. It is a business, and it's something they're trying to get out there, trying to get a message out there. And so I'm asking you guys, please go rate and review him. Please go rent it. purchase it, whatever, just in support of what they're doing and trying to make a difference in the movie industry as far as getting a good, positive message out there. So anyways, love you guys. I'd love to hear your feedback. Please get in touch with Casey and I. And remember, be real, be authentic, and be you. God bless.
That's all for this episode of Are You Real? Finding the Authentic You. Be sure to go to rureal.org for your free questionnaire to identify your gifts and talents and how you can use them to help people become leaders and catapult them into their destiny to help others become the leaders of tomorrow. We appreciate you spending your time with us and look forward to helping you reach out and revolutionize next time on Are You Real? Finding the Authentic You.